Welcome to Drive Time GP, a podcast exclusively for healthcare professionals. The Baker Type 2 Diabetes and Heart Failure Miniseries, Part 6, Spotting CKD Early, Optimizing Care to Slow Progression with SGLT2 Inhibitors.
Chronic kidney disease is a growing health problem in Australia, with more than 6 million Australian adults at risk of CKD, which is chronic kidney disease, and more than 2 million living with CKD. CKD is twice as common as type 2 diabetes, yet only 1 in 10 persons with CKD are aware that they actually have the disease, largely because it is an asymptomatic condition, with almost 90% of renal function being lost before becoming evident. I'm Anita Sharma, a GP based in Brisbane in Queensland. Today, we are joined by Professor Simon Roger, a consultant nephrologist and director at the renal unit in Gosford Hospital in New South Wales. Dr. Roger is with us today to take us through the recent developments and guideline recommendations for the use of SGLT2 inhibitors in the treatment of CKD, and to enlighten us about some of the screening tools for early detection of CKD. Welcome, Professor Roger.
Thank you, Anita.
So, up until recently, apart from RAS inhibitors, there had almost been a drought when it came to treatment options for CKD management. The arrival of SGLT2 class has definitely been a game changer, in that although first heralded as diabetes drugs, we are now seeing their impressive cardiorenal benefits. Can you take us through what the role of SGLT2 inhibitors is in treating CKD, and more importantly, how has the SGLT2 class come to be included in CKD management guidelines?
There have been multiple trials showing that the SGLT2 inhibitors are effective in delaying the progression of chronic kidney disease in people with and also without diabetes. And it's been years since we've had any new drugs come onto the market that we can use. We're now talking about four pillars of management. So the ACE inhibitors, the ARBs, then also the mineralocorticoid antagonists, such as finerenone that's come out, Kerendia is the trade name for that, and the SGLT2 inhibitors. So we've got a few things in our armory now to slow the progression of the CKD.
Mm-hmm.
So both international and local guidelines now recommend that those drugs are used. They say that you shouldn't start SGLT2 inhibitors if the eGFR is less than 20 mL per minute, 1.73 meters squared, but you still may get the non-renal benefits. And in the trials, they never stopped the drugs when the GFR dropped below that level.
So much like in heart failure, now we have four pillars in management of chronic kidney disease as well. And that's great because we have so many more treatment options for our patients. So it appears that SGLT2 inhibitors as a class have been recommended, as you said, by both international and local guidelines. Could you expand on which SGLT2 inhibitors are approved in Australia for use in CKD? And what are the prescription criteria that GPs need to be aware of? And perhaps what are some of the precautions and do's and don'ts that they should be also cognizant of?
Empagliflozin, Jardiance, or in combination with metformin, and dapagliflozin, Forxiga, again, can be combined with metformin, the two available.
So, empagliflozin is now approved for use in CKD patients.
Yeah, so really it's the only one that demonstrates a reduction in the combined risk of kidney disease progression or cardiovascular death, and that's in a range of people with CKD. And we know the cardiovascular complications go hand in hand with kidney disease. The drug's efficacious, is tolerable, and it can reduce the progression of CKD and death from cardiovascular causes by 28% compared to placebo, which is a very impressive result considering the majority of patients were already on an ACE or ARB.
As you've just outlined very clearly, that empagliflozin has now been approved for use in CKD patients. Could you shed some light on the evidence that actually led to this guidance?
Well, the main trial was called EMPA-Kidney. It was a study of over 6,000 patients, and it included a broad range of people with CKD. And half of them had diabetes mellitus, and half of them had the lower eGFR. So it was very broad. It should be noted, though, that DAPA-CKD, which was the dapagliflozin trial and EMPA-KIDNEY, had different inclusion and exclusion criteria that I'd mentioned. So really, the trials can't be directly compared. Also, the prevalence of diabetes and glomerulonephritis in the EMPA-KIDNEY was 30% with diabetic kidney disease, 25% with glomerulonephritis. And diabetic nephropathy is really the epidemic. And those numbers reflect the causes of people ending up with end-stage kidney disease requiring dialysis or a transplant.
So from what you've just told us, the EMPA-KIDNEY trial included a fairly broad patient population.
It did.
Which is really reassuring for us GPs, given that such a broad inclusion criteria perhaps represents better the real-world patients that GPs see in their practices.
Very much so, very much so.
Yeah. So could you run us through the key findings of the EMPA-KIDNEY trial, just in summary?
Just a couple of comments. For the family doctors who read medical articles, they talk about the hazard ratio. And in the EMPA-KIDNEY trial, there was a 28% lower risk of progression of CKD or death from the cardiovascular causes. So that means that if you had X number of people in the treatment arm that got it over Y in the control arm, it comes out 0.72. So that's a 28% reduction in the hazard ratio. And the trial slowed CKD progression across all GFRs and all albumin excretion rates, which it is very much applicable to the real-world situation.
Irrespective of baseline eGFR, irrespective of presence or absence of diabetes, it really gave the benefits.
Yeah.
So while the growing health burden of CKD in Australia is definitely a challenge for GPs, the availability of renal protective drugs like SGLT2 inhibitors also offers a great opportunity, I think, now. So I guess it's critical that we GPs have CKD on our radar when we see patients at risk of CKD, which are most of the patients we see with other comorbidities. So given the time pressures in primary care, do you have any tips regarding some easy-to-use tools for timely detection of CKD by a busy GP?
Kidney Health Australia is one of our support organisations, and they have a checklist. So when the patients are in assessing their blood pressure, if they have a blood test for a serum creatinine to calculate the eGFR and also to look at the albumin-creatinine ratio. If the results indicate chronic kidney disease, repeat the test. And they have a great algorithm in this Kidney Health Australia Chronic Kidney Disease Management in Primary Care Handbook. It's a free download. The only pest is it's 88 pages, so it's very extensive and thorough. But the algorithm is on page 16. And in my practice, for some things I have to refer to a lot, I just print it off and stick it in the top drawer so I can pull it out and see where things should be applied.
That's a great tip. I think Kidney Health Australia is a valuable resource for every GP. And just going zooming into that page, which has the three steps, the three-pronged approach in diagnosing CKD, is brilliant. Now, you did mention urinary ACR, which unfortunately, as shown in the REVEAL study conducted in primary care in Australia, is often not checked in a large proportion of patients. Can you explain to us what is the significance of measuring urinary albumin-creatinine ratio when it comes to CKD diagnosis and, say, prognostication?
When I have a patient who has glomerulonephritis, I use the analogy of the filters of the kidney, the glomeruli, being like a tea strainer. And if the holes are too big or there's tears, then blood or protein or albumin get into the urine the same way that tea leaves get into the cup. I often get referrals where the family doctors have undertaken an albumin-creatinine ratio, but they haven't looked for associated hematuria, and that really changes the possibilities for it. So it is important to do it. Some people refer to the microalbuminuria as a marker of endothelial dysfunction within their glomeruli. And the higher the albumin loss in the urine, the worse prognosis for the kidneys. So that's why we try and reduce it with ACE inhibitors, ARBs, and SGLT2 inhibitors.
So it's a very significant indicator of kidney damage. And I guess it's very closely associated with outcomes. So we should be really vigilant about looking for it and looking at the trend, I guess. So it's very clear that we need to embed SGLT2 inhibitor use into routine care for people with CKD, and perhaps sooner than later. Could you perhaps give us some guidance on how GPs should incorporate the use of such efficacious drugs and integrate it into their treatment algorithms more efficiently and more often?
Yeah, rather than the diabetics, it's important to remember their use in patients with chronic kidney disease, with or without diabetes. And it's because of the treatment adds so many other cardiorenal benefits. But for any type 2 diabetics who are not receiving it, they should be because of the cardiorenal benefits as well as lowering the HbA1c. When I start people on SGLT2 inhibitors, you may need to stop them because of thrush or urinary tract infections. And I also tell the patients not to take it on sick days, where if they were sick enough not to go to work, not to have it that day or a few days later, is because of the risk of ketoacidosis. I think it is important to knock off the diuretics for a couple of days beforehand and also one of the antihypertensives because of the risk with the naturesis losing sodium or the diuresis using fluid with it, that they can drop their blood pressure. And for the blood test results, just remember that especially people with better renal function, that their eGFR will drop when they go into the SGLT2 inhibitors. It's reversible, it's expected, and just ignore it. Because what happens is that it then slows the rate of decline of the kidney function over time. So it's a much flatter curve than if they weren't on it, where it just heads downwards towards needing dialysis.
So that little drop in eGFR should not be a reason to stop them. In
fact, no, it's certainly not. Just it's expected.
It doesn't recover.
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. Now, the benefit of this class has clearly been established, and they offer us a great opportunity to change the trajectory of renal disease in our patients. Now, unfortunately, it still has been underprescribed. You know, like you said, it should be considered in almost every patient with type 2 diabetes or has CKD. If I could ask you to give an opinion here, how many CKD patients in Australia do you think would be estimated to be eligible for an SGLT2 inhibitor just based on the clinical criteria?
That's a very hard question. Brendan Nguyen, who works at Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney, published earlier this year suggesting that there was a lot of undertreatment in the community. But the trial was done 3-4 years ago when the data was collected, and then 44% of patients with CKD were eligible, but only 4.1 were receiving treatment. I would really believe that that has increased a lot. With the referrals that I get from family doctors, more and more of them are prescribing the SGLT2 inhibitors.
So I think you've given us a very enlightening discussion on the role of SGLT2 inhibitors in CKD management. I have certainly learned a lot today about the prevalence, the morbidity and mortality of chronic kidney disease, and more importantly, the urgency for timely detection by primary care, who are often the first and sometimes the only point of contact for many patients. So I guess it's a call for action for us to really look for CKD and treat it more aggressively. For our GPs listening in today, could you please summarize the key take-home messages regarding early and optimal management of CKD?
Well, firstly, and the take-home message is that the progression of CKD can be substantially reduced if it's detected and treated early. The guidelines, both domestic and international, support that. The SGLT2 inhibitors have multiple metabolic and direct cardioprotective and nephroprotective effects. They are part of the four pillars of treatment. So the EMPA-KIDNEY with Jardiance did provide supporting evidence for the wider use of SGLT2 inhibitors, both with lower, higher GFRs, albuminuria, or no albuminuria, and the wide range of chronic kidney disease. So it is an opportunity to optimize care by detecting CKD and albuminuria early and slow the rate of progression so we're not having to put them onto artificial kidney treatment with dialysis.
Right. Thank you very much. That has been very useful.
Thanks very much.
Before prescribing the treatments discussed, please review the full product information. The substantiating references can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute in collaboration with Boehringer Ingelheim and Eli Lilly and produced in December 2024. The statements, conclusions, and opinions contained in this interview are those of the participating spokesperson and not necessarily those of the supporting organisation nor Drive Time Radio Australia Proprietary Limited. The statements, conclusions, and opinions contained in this interview are those of the participating spokesperson and not necessarily those of the supporting organisation nor Drive Time Radio Australia Proprietary Limited.